Chinese society showed a refinement in porcelain work, in silk embroidery, and in social refinement that no other society could match. No wonder the Chinese emperors regarded themselves as the sons of heaven and their part of the world as the center of the universe. Equally impressive in the year 1500 were the achievements of Islamic civilization. Starting in the 7th century, the Islamic Empire spread rapidly until it sprawled across three continents, Europe, Asia, and Africa. The Muslims unified their enormous empire around a single faith, Islam, and a single language, Arabic. The Islamic world enjoyed a flourishing economy, enriched by trade with India and the Far East, and a largely uniform system of laws. The Muslims built spectacular cities, Baghdad, Damascus, Cairo, Istanbul, Seville, Granada, distinguished by architectural and literary splendor. Islamic literature and thought exhibited a richness, variety, and complexity that far surpassed that of Europe at the time. Islam produced great men of learning, such as Avicenna, Averroes, Ibn Khaldun, Al-Ghazali, Al-Farabi, and Al-Kindi. Indeed, much of Greco-Roman knowledge, including the works of Aristotle, that had been lost in Europe during the Dark Ages, was preserved in the Islamic world. It is no exaggeration to write, in the words of historian David Landis, that during this period, Islam was Europe's teacher. Nothing could compare to China and the Islamic Empire, but there were other civilizations in the world in the year 1500. There was the civilization of India, renowned for its spiritual depth as the original home of two of the world's great religions, Hinduism and Buddhism, and also famous for its wealth and mathematical learning. In Africa, there were the kingdoms of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai, which were large, orderly, and rich in gold. Finally, in the Americas, there were the Aztec and Inca civilizations. Despite their reputation for brutality and human sacrifice, these were impressive for their architecture, social organization, and city planning. Western civilization, then called Christendom, was a relative backwater. Mired in the Dark Ages, Christendom was characterized by widespread ignorance, poverty, and incessant clashes between warring tribes and between kings and the church. Indeed, Islamic writers who encountered the West in the late Middle Ages describe it as remote, uninteresting, and primitive. A Muslim traveler described Europeans as more like beasts than like men. They lack keenness of understanding and clarity of intelligence, and are overcome by ignorance and apathy, lack of discernment and stupidity. Another Muslim writer gives an account of the state of European medicine. He tells of a knight who came to a European physician complaining of an abscess on his leg. The physician seized an axe and chopped off the leg with one blow, and the man died at once. Bernard Lewis finds in such Muslim writings the same note of amused disdain as we sometimes find among European travelers in Africa and Asia many centuries later. How then did this relatively impoverished, backward civilization accumulate so much economic, political, and military power that it was able to conquer and subdue all the other cultures of the world put together? There are two popular theories to answer this question. The first is the environmental school, and its thesis is conveyed by the title of a recent book, The Geography Behind History. According to this view, cultures are the product of location and natural resources, and whether a culture develops or remains stagnant depends on such factors as the availability of mineral resources, climate, proximity to rivers, and such. Africa, for example, is much larger than Europe, but has a shorter, navigable coastline, and therefore it seems to enjoy fewer possibilities for commerce. The most eloquent expression of the environmental argument is given by Jared Diamond in his best-selling book, Guns, Germs, and Steel. Diamond argues that Europe enjoyed immense natural advantages in prehistoric times that gave it a head start over the other cultures of the world. The environmental thesis does help to account for the origins of the earliest human civilizations. The flourishing of these civilizations did, in fact, depend decisively on access to water. Thus, the civilization of the Fertile Crescent was made possible by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. Not for nothing has ancient Egypt been termed the gift of the Nile. Other ancient civilizations developed on the banks of the Indus River in India and the Yellow River in China. But beyond this, the environmental thesis in general, and Diamond's arguments in particular, are useless in explaining the triumph of the West. After all, if Diamond is right that Europe enjoyed a natural advantage from ancient times, then why did this lead not become manifest until modern times? For more than 1,000 years, say between AD 500 and AD 1500, the West was a civilizational laggard, and showed no signs of becoming the world's dominant civilization. As we have seen, all bets were on China and the Islamic world. For the success of the West in the past 500 years in coming from behind to take over the world, Diamond and the environmental school have no plausible explanation. Despite its intellectual limitations, the environmental school retains its appeal among critics of the West because it attributes the civilizational superiority of Europe largely to chance. But there is a second, even more popular explanation within the anti-Western camp. According to this view, the reason that Western civilization became dominant in the past 500 years is because it is evil. Oppression, and specifically the crimes of ethnocentrism, colonialism, imperialism, and racism, is said to be the key to Western success. This may be called the school of oppression theory, and its thesis may be summarized in the statement that the West grew rich and powerful by beating up everybody else and taking their stuff. Oppression theory is highly favored by advocates of multiculturalism because it allows them to account for the disjunction between their dogma of cultural equality, i.e., that the cultures of the world are far from equal. Multiculturalists reason that because all cultures are equal, existing inequality is undoubtedly the consequence of some cultures oppressing others. A few years ago, Jesse Jackson led a group of protesters at Stanford University with banners advertising the sins of the West. Jackson and the demonstrators chanted, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western culture's got to go." A more scholarly version of the oppression thesis can be found in the works of Edward Said, particularly in his influential study, Orientalism, and his more recent book, Culture and Imperialism. Outside the West, oppression theory is also popular among Third World intellectuals, like the Marxist scholar Samir Amin, author of Eurocentrism. Another Marxist, Walter Rodney, blames European colonialism for draining African wealth and making it impossible to develop more rapidly the resources of the continent. A similar note is struck by the African writer Chinwezu, who offers the following explanation for African underdevelopment. White hordes have sallied forth from their Western homelands to assault, loot, occupy, rule, and exploit the world. Even now, the fury of their expansionist assault upon the rest of us has not abated. Perhaps the most forceful exponent of oppression theory is the anti-colonial writer Frantz Fanon. Fanon writes, "European opulence has been founded on slavery. The well-being and progress of Europe have been built up with the sweat and the dead bodies of Negroes, Arabs, Indians, and the yellow races." In recent years, Fanon's oppression thesis has been taken up with a vengeance by many in the Islamic world. Islamic radicals are familiar with and frequently cite Fanon, and Muslim devotees of his work go considerably beyond the bin Laden circle. Even many Muslims who do not condone terrorism seem firmly to believe that they are poor because the West is rich, that somehow the West is to blame for their poverty and misery. The multicultural remedy is a simple one. Multiculturalists call upon the West to publicly atone for its sins and pay up. Reparations for slavery is the favored approach. Jesse Jackson strongly supports the idea. African-American activist Randall Robinson advocated it in a recent book. Black lawyers like Johnny Cochran and Charles Ogletree are drawing up a legal strategy to promote it through the courts. And members of the Congressional Black Caucus have taken up the political cudgels to convince the U.S. government to go along. For many Third World and Islamic activists, reparations are not enough. For them, the crimes of the West provide a justification for violence. Fanon himself advocated such violence. The native is an oppressed person whose permanent dream is to become the persecutor. and his battle cry has been taken up by Islamic radicals who have found in it an added pretext for jihad.